You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
I want to start with a discussion of the language of the frontier. That's kind of the job I was somewhat given, I think, and it's something I've worked on. So it's not that it's in any way difficult, but that language of the frontier does a tremendous amount of work in terms of justifying and explaining the way in which cities are being changed. And the idea of an urban frontier, it seems to me, is highly redolent of a very particular kind of history in especially European North American terms. It has a broader application, but it's a very European North American axis, I think, that's being appealed to in that language of the frontier. And as Jeff suggested, the frontier is filled with brave pioneers going boldly where no white man, presumably, has ever gone before, bravely conquering the natives, treating them like part of the natural environment, sticking them in reservations, and otherwise stealing their property, and probably in the process committing genocide. Now, it's not an accident that such violent images get naturalized into a discussion of how cities are being retaken these days. And that's what I think is so powerful about the urban frontier imagery. So just to make it clear, for me, I want to be very critical of that language of urban frontiers. There's no good way through that language. It's not a language, I think, that we need to find ourselves lingering with. It really conjures up this notion of progress on the one side versus wilderness on the other. And of course, what both notions do is in part to take the individuals out. Progress is this almost natural process that just happens with the progression of time, whereas wilderness is a place that has no people in it. And of course, neither of those conceptualizations is true. But of course, it's the total dehumanization of the old environment of the 18th, 19th centuries, but also of the new urban environment. That's precisely the point about the deployment of that language of the frontier. Having said that, though, I having suggested that this language of the frontier really does amount to a highly, highly derogatory, very politically infused apology for the displacement and destruction of life that gentrification and various forms of urban change are taking right now, it does seem to me there's a reason why the language works. And I think it would be sad to lose a sense of the limited ways in which that language works. And that is that gentrification is an economic frontier. So here I am going back and trying to, rehabilitate the language of the frontier, if you like. And when you look at neighborhoods or you look at the city scale, what you often see is this really spatial spread of the process, not unlike a kind of archetypal spread of, Europeans from East Coast into the center to the west, but also from the West Coast into the center too. That spatialization, that geography of the frontier is very real. But it's real in economic terms. It's real in terms of what happens to ground rents, what happens to people's housing rents, to housing prices, to the price of land, and all of these things. Not so much in terms of the cultural kind of patina that we're supposed to all conjure up with the notion of the frontier. So it seems to me that's the insidious power of the language of the frontier, is exactly that there is a basis in reality to how it operates. The derogatoriness of the language is sometimes quite explicit. In the 1980s, in Burlington, Vermont, a group of business leaders got together and decided to create a program which they called Westward Ho. And of course, Westward Ho conjures up the whole frontier business from the 19th century anyway. But what was Westward Ho? Westward Ho was a program where they were going to go around Burlington and pick up homeless folks off the street and offer them tickets out of town. One-way tickets, of course, not return tickets. We were going to do this. And it was a program that got some public attention. I don't think there were a tremendous amount of people who took them up on it. But I actually happened to read last month in the Toronto Globe and Mail an interview with a couple of homeless people here in Vancouver where exactly the same tactic was being used. They couldn't really call it Westward Ho because, you know, there's a, there's a geographical issue unless you think of Vancouver Island, I suppose. But so they didn't actually call it Westward Ho. And this was being organized through the city administration in Vancouver. But it was clearly connected to the Olympics, and it was clearly, again, this kind of sense of frontier. And I just like to go back to Frederick Engels, who said, you know, at one point says, with Marx, I guess, the bourgeoisie has no solution to the housing crisis, they just move it around. And that's exactly what we're seeing in a different kind of a way. But that link with the frontier and gentrification becomes explicit in other kinds of ways, and not just with gentrification, but with urban building. So last year in May, I was actually in Edmonton giving a talk to a couple of local groups around the questions of gentrification. And I was wandering around in Edmonton, looking at some of the historic buildings, which all seem to be from just about right after the turn of the 20th century. And I started to notice a similarity on several of the plaques. And it said, and literally the language was the same, the historic plaques. It said, around 1910, which, you know, the age of the buildings that I was looking at, land became available. I went, I've never seen land become available. What does it look like when land becomes available, you know? So the forum that I was at that evening, I was raising this and obviously making the connections. And what was extraordinary to me was how the native folks who were there, the First Nations people, were very explicit about how gentrification was just a new name for colonialism. And when you read those plaques, land became available. For them, there was a continuity from that colonial experience of the 19th century especially, through to the experience of today, when land is suddenly being made available in the Boyle Street area of Edmonton, for example, for people who have the money to pay for it, and at the severe cost to the folks who already live there. So that frontier connection is highly metaphorical and yet dramatically and violently real at the same time. And I think that that's the tricky part that we have to keep in mind. But let me suggest too that frontier language is maybe not necessarily as powerful now as it was, I would say, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And again, this is very uneven depending on place. But I'm kind of noticing a drop off in its use, and maybe that's from academic circles. You just don't see it so much in New York now, for example. In preparing for this, I was trying to think through, and I haven't really thought this through before. Why is that? Why would there be a drop-off, a waning in the power of that frontier metaphor? And I thought at first, immediately trying to flatter all of us on the left, that it was probably because of the extraordinary power of our critique of the frontier metaphor that, of course, it had been dropped. I came up with a second idea. Actually, I do think there's a power to the critique, and I think this is one mistake that many of us in academia make, is that we kind of forget that the ideas that we're working with do have some effect outside academia. We have this sense of sort of concealing ourselves. Feeling ourselves to be concealed inside an ivory tower, which isn't quite as correct as I think I used to think it was. So I think there is some success to the critique, to be fair. But I think the other thing is the transparency of the politics of the language. When you talk about the frontier, then you do get things like a novel produced in the 1980s about Lower East Side in New York called Indian Country. Now, are we going to start calling neighborhoods that are targeted for gentrification Indian Country? Well, that kind of tells the truth a wee bit too much. and you're not really allowed to tell the truth quite that barely. So some other language kind of has to be found, I think. And I think what's begun to happen, too, is a whole set of alternative natural nature metaphors that are emerging. And there's a whole series of them. Revitalization, for example, has always been around and is still quite prevalent. The one that's really taken off in Europe most recently is regeneration, which is having a much more global appearance, I think. But the idea of regeneration, I mean, cities, neighborhoods don't regenerate. Plants regenerate. When I abuse my liver, my hope is it's going to regenerate, right? These are epidemiological, biological metaphors that are being used to naturalize a process as if gentrification was natural. So again, there's a kind of hidden, quite nasty politics within those metaphors. But the one that's coming up more and more now, I think, too, is sustainable cities and sustainable neighborhoods. So I think there's an alternative range of metaphors that's coming up to try and stay one step ahead of the critiques that are going on. But the fourth reason I think that the language of the frontier is waning, and this is one I want to spend a little time on, is because I think the process of gentrification itself is changing quite dramatically. And that's kind of what I want to now spend a couple of minutes on. When we think about the gentrification process, and especially the language of the frontier, if we don't think about it critically, there's a very kind of homey, cuddly sense to, you know, redoing houses and making them look good again and architecturally authentic and heritage and all these good, nice words that cover a multitude of sins. But in fact, I think the gentrification process now is very different from when that imagery of sort of one by one, house by house kind of rehab was the norm, was the dominant process. And I think there's about five ways in which I think the process has changed. And I'll just go through these very, very quickly and you know, we can talk about them, but then I want to try and get a wee bit more specific. Gentrification began in the 50s, 60s, 70s as something that took place in the interstices of the housing market. It was a house here, a neighborhood there, a street there, but lots of other places just unaffected. And it really was in the interstices. And I think that what's happened now is that the process of gentrification has become more systematic and more systemic, and quite dramatically so. And one of the just clear pieces of truth or pieces of factual evidence, I think, to back that up, is that whereas in the 1970s and through much of the 1980s, gentrification as a process was counter-cyclical. It wasn't really too much affected by the ups and downs, even in the housing market, never mind the broader economy. As research, some of it done here actually by David Lay, probably the most direct research on exactly this topic, but there's a lot of evidence from all around the place. As research now is clear about crises and ups and downs in the housing market now affect gentrification very sharply and very directly. It's become, gentrification now systemic. It's not a marginal process in any way whatsoever anymore. So that's the first change, I think, that's happened. And I think this has really happened since the 1980s. The second, and this is obviously connected, is that rather than a somewhat voluntaristic process, and I don't want to overestimate how much it was individuals who were responsible for the gentrification process in the beginning. Banks were always, savings and loans, mortgage lending institutions were always in there pushing money on people to do the gentrification. But contrary to that, I think that now what's happening is that gentrification is broadly planned. It's planned between the state and the free market, so to speak. It's become one alternative for a certain section of city building, to give it a broader term. It's become one alternative to the liberal urban policy, which now, of course, lies in shatters and has done really since the 1980s. So gentrification is the leading edge of one kind of urban rebuilding that's going on now, and in that sense, it really is planned. This is kind of harping on the same topic, but it's moved from being a kind of occasional process to being highly generalized and indeed globalized. It's generalized in two ways. It's globalized geographically. In the 1980s, when we talked about gentrification, we were thinking about, you know, New York and Philadelphia, London, Paris, Sydney, maybe, and that was probably about it. We were talking about two continents, maybe Tokyo, but there really wasn't much outside North America and Europe. That's no longer true. With the possible exception of Antarctica, I haven't yet read that article. I think there have been sightings of the gentrification process in major cities in every continent. And I'm not even going to get into some of these, although I'm going to talk about Beijing a wee bit in a minute. But it's also structurally generalized as a process, by which I mean that it's generalized down the urban hierarchy. So it's not just the New Yorks and Londons, it's small towns of 50,000 or 80,000. And the rationale for the gentrification process now has an awful lot to do with multiple other economic types of processes. It's linked into the global political economy and social economy. So tourism, for example, is an obvious and huge catalyst for the gentrification process, which can affect relatively small towns, whether in the Caribbean or wherever. So that's the three. Four, there's an ideological shift that's taken place in the way that gentrification's changed. In the 1980s, gentrification was such a dirty word that the New York Real Estate Board, which is kind of like a chamber of commerce of all the big developers, had to take out an ad, and they did this twice, 83 and 85, in the pages of the New York Times, the op-ed piece down at the bottom and the second-to-back page, which was pioneered by Mobil Oil during the oil crisis in the 70s, but I'm digressing. The Real Estate Board took out an ad that says, "Is gentrification a dirty word?" Right. And this actually got quite a lot of play in lots of different ways. And for people who are in the gentrification literature, this is obviously known. But they had to be extraordinarily defensive to explain that gentrification was just about giving normal working class people $500,000 houses, and how could that be bad? So they had to go through that work. Now they have, and there's been an ideological backlash against the use of the word, such that just 3 days ago in the Toronto Globe and Mail, another headline was, "It's sometimes a bumpy road to gentrification." Gentrification gets this whole new positive inflection coming out of it in a way that was not true then. So that's changed, I think, about how we see and think about gentrification. The language of regeneration, especially in Europe, is part of that process. But so too is the language of sustainability, which I mentioned before. So that, for example, in the name of sustainable cities, there's a protracted effort by the Copenhagen municipal government to evict people from Christiania, which, as some of you may know, is a large area in Copenhagen in Denmark, which is squatted. I don't really know how many people are there, several hundred people, if not more, who live in the area. Mm-hmm. And quite explicitly, the now conservative city fathers, so to speak, have said that it's economically unsustainable for these people to live there. Mm-hmm. So the whole environmental language of sustainability is being deployed in order to grease the wheels of this gentrification. Okay, so you know, how do we then start to try and bring this down to ground a bit? Well, you know, we've just been watching the Olympics last month, and I'm in no way an expert on Beijing, but if you look at the way that Beijing has been transformed for the Olympics this year, it demonstrates each of these five kinds of shifts in the meaning of gentrification, the scale of the process, which actually I think I forgot to mention at the end there, but that's kind of obvious. The scale of gentrification is just way huger than 20 years ago. The systematic nature of it, the planned character of it, its generalization globally. Beijing, we would never have been talking about gentrification in Beijing in the 1980s, and its ideological components. So that, of course, the Olympics became a means of galvanizing a sense of urban pride and identity in Beijing with a sense of national pride, with then a much more hard-headed, thoroughly capitalist logic of urban regeneration. The language of regeneration wasn't always the language that was used. It was more a question of city building. I mean, there's no pretense anymore, of course, that the Chinese government has anything to do with communism. But they've quite successfully rewritten Lenin's highest stages of capitalism to suggest that capitalism is actually the highest stage of communism. And that's pretty much what we saw coming over in the screens recently. Now, what's the cost of that? You know, I've been living and working in New York for a while now, and lots of people in New York tend to think New York's the center of the world. The scale of gentrification in New York is minuscule compared to what's happening elsewhere. Even London has a huger scale of gentrification, if you look at what's happening along the Thames, than New York does. It's barely on the radar, New York. Then you look at Beijing, and the estimates of the number of people displaced in Beijing to build the Olympics. The lowest estimate that I've been able to find was 600,000. The highest estimates are over a million people displaced. Now, I don't want to exaggerate and suggest that all of this is sort of gentrification, but a large chunk of it is. The point being that the systematic nature of gentrification now ties residential change to economic change, to land use change, to recreational change, to environmental change. It's a whole project of city building that's going on here. And that's what I think we were seeing in Beijing. It's also important to think back to other experiences. The ones I know better around the Olympics are LA and Atlanta, for example, in the US, when I was already living there. And there was certainly displacement taking place, quite deliberate displacement taking place there, but nothing of the scale of what happened in Beijing. And of course, one of the reasons for this is precisely that you've got this perfect storm of state power with economic power, and that the state can do things within the capitalist market in China that you could never get away with in much of the West. That's actually why London is got a comparatively greater scale, I would argue, of gentrification than New York is because of greater state involvement in the market. Now, I'm not making that as a critique of the state or not, or of different systems. I just think it's that different nexus of state and economy that's really crucial in explaining the scale of it. And such that even in London now, the whole language is, whoa, we're totally outclassed by what Beijing did with the Olympics. There's no way, even in London, that we can possibly remake the city and recreate such a spectacle as what Beijing did at all. So the importance of that point is to say that there's not kind of straight line evolutionary necessity or inevitability to any of this stuff. It really is uneven from place to place, depending on, you know, many, many things. But, you know, we can see the trajectories and the tendencies, I think. Now, let me just move, before I try and just round off, finish off, let me just move to Vancouver. And here I'm really on shaky ground. You guys all know an awful lot more about Vancouver. But I maybe just let me try and do this by raising a few questions and have that be grist for the panel, or else they can happily ignore anything idiotic that I say, but also for questions. I mean, I think the likelihood is that the kinds of shifts that are clearly already afoot in Vancouver, and you're going to see before 2010 in intensified form, are going to be much kinder and gentler, to use that bad language, than Beijing. I mean, we're not talking about something of that scale. There's, you know, again, there's a lot of reasons for that, many of which are obvious. And part of it, I think, is the Winter Olympics is not actually such a big show as the Summer Olympics. I think that's part of the equation. But I think it's also, maybe this is a point for discussion. Is why that might be so. But I think the comparative lack, I don't want to say lack of power, the limited nature of state power in the land market is a central part of that of that calculation. But that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be shifts that take place. And again, I think it was in the Globe and Mail. Sorry for my Toronto-based New York knowledge of Vancouver, but I'll let you guys figure it out. I saw that after the premier of BC was actually grilled in Beijing on what he was going to do about homelessness for the 2010 Olympics, that within 2 days, a tent city of, I think if I'm right, the figures were about 40 folks living in Oppenheimer Park, not too far from here, as you know, were just summarily evicted. So there's a very direct connection going on there between the attacks on homeless people. And I think I'm sure you all have many, many more stories of that sort that you can tell. Okay, so what are we going to do about it instead of just, you know, complaining about it? And what's likely to happen? I mean, actually, the events of today and yesterday in the market could have a significant effect. And it's, I'm now reverting to my New York-based knowledge via Toronto of Vancouver. So, but the event, what happened yesterday and today, especially the nationalisation, which just was announced a couple of hours ago, the nationalisation of AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the United States, is actually phenomenal. And what it suggests is the depth of the economic crisis. Now, there's no way that economic crisis is staying inside Wall Street or the subprime market or even the United States. This is already a global crisis. The British Treasury Secretary, what do they call him, Chancellor of the Exchequer, said about a week and a half ago that basically Britain was in the worst economic meltdown in 60 years. Now, when that's happening in Britain, and AIG is being taken over for a cool $85 billion by the Bush government, this is the anti-socialist, neoliberal, keep the state out of people's business, Bush government. You know, when those things are happening, there's some real economic rumblings ahead, and that really is going to affect, I think, how not just gentrification in a small way, but how city building gets done over the next year or two. Because city building has become, and Henri Lefebvre was actually very good at this, I think, in pinpointing the fact that city building itself, the building of the built environment, actually becomes one of the central productive mechanisms of the economy. We're all stuck in this idea that real estate, you know, we think fire, finance, insurance, real estate, and so on, is the service economy. No, building the built environment, building cities, is this massively productive source of profit and surplus value in the economies, and there's no way that that's not going to be affected by those kinds of economic shifts. It's going to mean an awful lot of disinvestment, not just in the narrow subprime market crisis, but in broader ways, housing prices coming down, people finding that their homes are worth less than the debt that they owe in them through the mortgages and so on and so forth. And so that kind of disinvestment is also going to have a geographical character to it. So I'm going to stick my neck out a bit and say it looks to me like there's going to be a spread into the suburbs of that disinvestment, followed quite quickly, again, depending on economic conditions, reinvestment in the economy and so on, a kind of suburbanization of the gentrification process too. I mean, you can already begin to see that kind of shifting geography begin to happen. That could take 5 years or it could take 20 years, or depending on other possibilities, it may not happen at all. So that's the other possibilities I want to come to. in a second, but I think in the meantime, the events of today mean that the assumptions of a neoliberal capitalism are really gone. Jürgen Habermas used to say about modernism that it was dead but dominant. And I think that's exactly the right language for neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is now dead. There are no ideas around in neoliberalism anymore. But at the same time, it remains dominant. It remains the dominant ethos, even if there's nothing new coming out. So I think the challenge for us then is to start to think through, okay, what would the alternatives look like? And here I think there's really an opportunity. I mean, the left has been asleep. In at least North America and parts of Europe, I think, for the last 20 years. And I say that as a self-critique as much as I'm not pointing fingers except as much at myself. But we've tended to be asleep and ineffectual. But there's an opportunity now because there really is no more momentum to this neoliberal juggernaut that we've faced. So how do we begin to think that through in terms of questions of gentrification, urban change, and so on? And just two totally modest and not in the least original ideas. And I think the broader idea is really the idea of the right to the city. There's really a building movement right now of community groups that are beginning to talk in that language, again, Lefebvre, of the right to the city. And I think that makes an awful lot of sense. I think you make that kind of social justice movement at the scale of the city. And that means a right to housing, but it also means a right to jobs. And that jobs and housing are not disconnected. It also means a right to services, and that the services and the housing and the jobs are not themselves disconnected. There's no point in providing homeless people jobs if they don't have services and housing. You can't provide homeless people housing without, you know, all the rest of it. So it's a much more integrated sense of the right to the city that I think we need to be working with. And I think that probably makes a lot of sense compared to perhaps the older, narrower anti-gentrification struggles that I think many of us have been involved in, and where we really did focus on gentrification as a much narrower process. But I think if we take seriously the critique of how gentrification has changed, the generalization, the globalization, the systematization of gentrification, then it makes sense to think in broader kinds of terms of political resistance, such as the right to the city. And quite how that works out in any one place, of course, is highly contingent. There's no inevitabilities at all. That there will be forms of resistance, I think, is pretty inevitable. Quite how intense they are or aren't, again, it's difficult to estimate and to predict. But I think the fact of that kind of sets of demands now being set up and now getting some kind of public airing are very real. It was actually very heartening today. I got a brief chance to. I always watch CNN. You should always know what those folks are doing. So I was watching CNN, and the right wing has come apart. They have absolutely no idea what to do about the economic crisis. They're in total crisis themselves ideologically. And I think, you know, okay, that's nice. Let's think of it as an opportunity, and let's think about really a quite modest idea of the right to the city and go for it. Thanks.